This is an ABC podcast.
A teenager's knee was hurting him so badly, he asked his dad to take him to the Broken Hill Hospital in the small hours of the morning. After his fourth time to emergency in less than 48 hours, the young man was pronounced dead from an infected toenail.
He should not have died in the manner and at the time he did die. I think we as a medical profession, we as a health service in New South Wales, we failed Alex Brace and we failed his family.
And talk in the Pilbara region that Australia's most famous Kelpie could get a highway named after him.
He used to go to some of the railway camps along the way. He'd run out on the road and get me to stop for him. So to me, that road depicted Red Dog.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide. But first, it's a bushfire situation that's been described as unprecedented and an omen for the season ahead. In the last few days, bushfires have destroyed and damaged dozens of homes and structures across New South Wales and Queensland. Over 50 fires have been raging across Queensland, and the situation today worsened in New South Wales with a bushfire emergency declared around Shark Creek near Yamba. To make matters worse, many of the fires are occurring in drought-affected areas where communities are on water restrictions and there's already limited feed for livestock. James Morris is a spokesperson from the New South Wales Rural Fire Service and he joins me now. Now, what is the latest on the bushfire emergencies there in New South Wales, James?
Yeah, good evening, Sinead. Look, we've got over 51 bush and grass fires burning across New South Wales at the moment, with just over 20 of them still yet to be contained. Obviously, we're seeing significant winds right across the fire grounds in New South Wales here. So it's been a challenging week for firefighters, with obviously a number of fires burning across the state. Currently, we've seen more than 134,600 hectares burn out from the fires right across New South Wales in the coming week. So challenging conditions, and obviously that tonight further challenging conditions ahead for crews.
What's driving those unseasonal bushfires? What's behind them?
We're seeing obviously dry conditions right across New South Wales. Obviously with the dry fuels, the less rain that we've had in previous years. So all of that is a combination of what we're seeing now. So these winds are likely to hang around for the next week or so, at least from what we've been told, with a bit of a reprieve on Wednesday, but winds coming back again on Thursday morning. So I think it's certainly going to be a few challenging weeks ahead for our crews.
The fires are occurring in areas on water restrictions. What does that mean for the firefighting effort?
Yeah, certainly. So obviously we put in place dry firefighting measures as much as we can. So that involves things like, you know, using tactics such as backburning or implementing the use of heavy machinery a lot more, just to try and assist in reducing that amount of water that needs to be done. Obviously, there's considerations that are taken in place with that, such as, you know, we're obviously going to have to take out a lot more bushland if we're going to undertake backburning potentially. So there's a lot of factors involved, and it is a case-by-case basis. Certainly when it comes to those fires where we need to use water and we need to take water from tanks and dams and those private those water areas there in residence, obviously we will count the amount of litres that we do take out and replace that through local land services with programs that we've got.
It's only early September. We're just finished winter. What does it mean for the season ahead?
Yeah, it's certainly a challenging season ahead. Talking with the Bureau of Meteorology, they're saying we're in for above average temperatures and certainly below average rainfall. So given the dry landscape that we've got at the moment with over 98% of New South Wales are currently drought affected, obviously that's going to play havoc for firefighters, especially with no rain predicted in the foreseeable future.
James Morris from the New South Wales Rural Fire Service, thanks for chatting.
Thanks for your time.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And in news just in, the fire near Yamba, what's been called the Shark Creek Fire, has now been downgraded to a watch and act. This means there are currently no emergency level fires in New South Wales.
ABC Australia Wide.
The person who doesn't support a coal, they've probably been here 10 years, whereas someone who's been here for 40 will actually tell you the population of saltwater crocs we have in our river, ridiculous.
On ABC Radio.
Tonight, Four Corners turns the spotlight on the state of medical care provided in regional hospitals across Australia. Here's lawyer Tom Ballantyne speaking to journalist Louise Milligan.
Frankly, it's unacceptable that your postcode can determine the quality of healthcare you receive. And how we fix that, how we sort of change the balance is, you know, something that requires a lot of input from different, you know, from government, from the colleges, from the regulator, and, you know, frankly, more resources, more money.
Lawyer Tom Ballantyne speaking there. Four Corners finds the further you are away from a major city hospital, the higher the rates are for preventable deaths. Reporter Louise Milligan joins me now. Now, Louise, during this investigation, you found evidence that regional hospitals were really struggling to provide the kind of care you would expect in a first world country like Australia. Some of your investigation focuses on the case of Alex Braze. Can you tell me what happened to him?
Alex Braze's case is an absolutely shocking and heartbreaking, tragic case that happened in Broken Hill in far western New South Wales. Alex was 18 years old when he presented to Broken Hill Base Hospital's emergency department at 3:18 a.m. Now, obviously, to come to a hospital at that time, you know, as a otherwise healthy 18-year-old, you've got to be in an awful lot of pain, and he was. Now, he went to the hospital three times over that day, 3:18, 8 o'clock, 6 p.m., and over those three presentations, no vital sign observations were done. The hospital staff assumed that he had a sporting injury because he had a very sort of sore, swollen knee. They did an ultrasound, but that was it. And the following morning after that last presentation, he was sort of sent home, you know, saying to rest and elevate. He woke up in agony. He was unable to walk. He called his father home from work, and his father called an ambulance. The ambulance didn't come, said that it wouldn't come. And so his dad managed to, you know, bundle his 6'3" boy into the car, and then they got to the hospital and there was no wheelchair for 25 minutes. You know, but the time they got the wheelchair and went into the ED, he was in a really bad way. Again, the nurse through the triage window did not do the vital sign observations. Now, I live in Melbourne and I go to our local hospital emergency department, as you do a bit with my young kids. And every time that I go there, the first thing they do when they triage is take the temperature, take the pulse, you know, put the little thing on the finger for the oxygen saturations. That didn't happen once over these four occasions. So he went and he was wheeled back into the waiting room. His father asked for a pillow. The nurse refused a pillow. And then the nurse looked through the window and realised that he looked sweaty and basically realised that he was, you know, as desperately unwell as he was. And he was rushed in and he had to be resuscitated. And it was only at that point that they discovered that he had had a toenail infection which hadn't been picked up, and that it had gone into his bloodstream, and he was septic, he was in toxic shock, he had a thing called necrotizing fasciitis, which is an aggressive, flesh-eating disease. It took them 13 hours from the time that he arrived to the time that he finally arrived at Royal Prince Alfred in Sydney. He gets to Royal Prince Alfred at 12:50, and he goes into cardiac arrest and he dies at 2 a.m., 18 years old, 21st century Australia.
It's horrific. It's horrific as you step through it, particularly because you can imagine for that Braze family what that would have been like.
It's unbearable.
How are the doctors and nurses coping now that they realise that they've, you know, that this massive failure that happened at Broken Hill Regional Hospital that left this family in this situation?
Well, the doctors and nurses, there has been a big exodus of staff out of this hospital, not just because of what happened with Alex Braze, but because of what they perceived as management failures at that hospital. And they tried to get management to listen, and we have, you know, hundreds of pages of documents about this, over a long period of time, to their concerns about clinical governance and patient safety, and the doctors that we spoke to and a nurse said that, you know, that didn't, nothing really happened. They tried to set up a risk register, for instance, and the director of medical services, by their account, didn't want to do that. And then after the death happened, you know, there's another series of failures because it was downgraded under the sort of classification system in New South Wales Health. There's a severity assessment code. Now, this should have been in the highest category, a severity assessment code 1 or SAC 1. It was downgraded to the next one, and that meant that it wasn't immediately referred for an investigation to the Ministry of Health. It should have been done within 24 hours. And then there should have been an investigation completed under New South Wales law within 70 days. Now, that did not happen. And it was only when the doctors wrote to the New South Wales Health Minister in desperation and concern that eventually it happened. But it was 1 year after the event. And it was only at that time that Alex Braze's parents began to realise exactly how many things had gone wrong with their son's care, and that it wasn't just some terrible, you know, unavoidable freak event, but in fact that it was, due to systemic failures. Then the doctors, they wanted to highlight with the health minister that, you know, this didn't come in a vacuum, and that, you know, while there was a root cause analysis, you know, an investigation into the death, that was just into that particular death. They wanted to look at the death in the context of the broader management issues at this hospital. And so they went to meet with Brad Hazzard, the New South Wales Health Minister, last November, and they specifically talked about Alex Braze and other deaths and other near misses, sentinel events, as they're described in hospitals. And they say to me, you know, when they started talking about the deaths, that's when his kind of ears pricked up. And so he ordered a review by a health bureaucrat, and that review took several months to happen. When it came down, it didn't even mention the death of Alex Braze, or any death or mortality or morbidity or you know, any detail about clinical governance. And the doctors were just gobsmacked about that. And that's why they've come forward.
And did they come forward to you then, Louise? Is this how you found out about this particular case?
Yeah, absolutely. They decided to speak to our program. And, you know, at some sort of personal, professional risk to them, because they're blowing the whistle, but they just felt that they couldn't remain silent while this was happening, that something had to be done.
You look at this particular case, but you're looking at the quality of care across regional hospitals. Is this symptomatic of what's happening in regional hospitals in Australia?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, it goes without saying that there is lots of wonderful care given in regional and rural hospitals across the country by, you know, wonderful professionals. However, there is a big gap between what you get in the country and what you get in the city. And that's borne out in the statistics by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, which show that the further you get from a capital city, the higher the avoidable death rates, potentially avoidable death rates. And that is used as a measure for how we assess how well hospitals are operating. We looked at it, you know, several locations around the country and, you know, other really tragic cases, three of which involve teenagers, I might say, that just happened to not live in a capital city. And it just doesn't seem fair. I mean, on the one hand, you do have a lot of issues and they're to do with funding, and certainly you would be aware, I'm sure, that the Rural Health Alliance and the Rural Doctors Association before the last election were crying out for more, not just funding, but better policies in relation to this issue from both the coalition government and the opposition.
Louise Milligan, this is just a start of a conversation, but if you do want to find out more, you can catch tonight's Four Corners at 8:30 p.m. on ABC TV and on iView. Louise Milligan, thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Sinead. Appreciate it.
ABC Australia Wide.
I've had a good life, but I am the new homeless. as are many other well-educated people.
On ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. Now, tomorrow on Australia Wide, we will continue this conversation on the state of care in regional hospitals. The president of the Rural Doctors Association, Dr. Adam Coltsa, will join me. So if you would like to get involved in that conversation or have a question for him, why not get in touch on Australia Wide's contact page on the website. Carp may not be a staple down at your local fish and chip shop, but businesses in the Coorong region of South Australia are reporting an increasing demand for the fish and are supplying restaurants around Adelaide. They say there's a potential to grow the industry, but the federal government is looking at releasing the carp herpes virus into the Murray River to control the numbers, which fishers say is putting big markets off carp. Leonie Thorne went to Meningie and has this story.
So ideally what you do is you find a place like this, you put a net at the entrance, and then you go in round behind and you push them out. And then
Glenn Hill's been fishing in the Coorong for about 30 years, but 10 years ago he started catching and eating a fish he never thought he would.
There's no way that I would have ever said carp are a great fish. But really, that's such a silly thing for me to say. These fish are the most eaten and harvested fish in the world. Something tells me we're missing something here.
Carp's usually sold into the rock lobster bait market in small numbers. It's not worth that much. But during the millennium drought, fishermen started catching the fish in huge numbers to try and prevent a fish kill event. Finding themselves with huge amounts of extra fish to find markets for, businesses in the Coorong region researched how to prepare and market it for human consumption. And over the past 10 years, Glenn Hill says orders for carp have been creeping up.
And it's amazing what changes when fish that aren't worth anything suddenly become worth something. We're turning fish that was worth nothing into $20 a kilo.
But he's afraid it won't be worth much more if the national carp herpes virus release goes ahead. Glenn and his wife Tracy's business markets carp as a premium food. They currently supply restaurants in Adelaide and the Coorong, but Tracy Hill says they've had inquiries from overseas too.
I have one reasonably serious inquiry that would take 200,000 tonnes. Now that's going to be hard to do, and I believe if the government put as much effort into exploring markets and assisting fishermen to get a export market going properly, we wouldn't need to put a virus in at all.
It's that carp herpes virus the fishing industry says is preventing further investment in commercial harvesting. Tracy Hill says in order to export carp, the industry needs resources, the kind of infrastructure to store and ship huge amounts of fish overseas, staff, investment, and work into developing markets.
The problem is most markets don't want to look at starting anything up while this virus is hanging over their heads.
Is that the main issue?
Pretty much. You're not going to invest major resources, money, infrastructure into a project that maybe within 3 to 5 years is cancelled because they put the virus in the river system.
The National Carp Control Plan Coordinator has said research has already been done into commercial harvesting. They said it shows alone it could not effectively control the European carp species. Tintinara-based estuarine ecologist Faith Coleman says that may be true, but she says releasing the virus would stop the possibility of exploring commercial harvest along with other control methods.
Potential solutions around commercial carp control, not a solution in itself, but it's part of a solution. Commercial carp removal and even recreational removal for human consumption won't work if we've got the virus out there, because you don't really want to be eating fish that have got herpes sores all over them. And so there's issues around if we release the virus, what are we saying we don't want to do?
The National Carp Control Plan says the herpes virus release would be an effective way to deal with the large numbers of carp in the river system. But back in the Coorong, Glenn Hill fears for a budding industry that could be wiped out before it even takes off.
Nobody from overseas is going to invest in the infrastructure that they need to get product from our shores to there for the same reasons.
And you think there's interest in doing that from overseas markets?
I can only say what they've been telling us, and that's, yes, they want our fish, but not with the virus. They don't want to start anything if the virus is on the table.
Burrung fisherman Glenn Hill ending Leonie Thorne's story. And if this story fascinates you, you can find out a bit more on ABC Online.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
You don't have to fit a certain shape or person or, you know, anyone can do it.
I could see that she was starting to expand because it's a solid piece of wax.
On ABC Radio.
It's been 40 years since the death of Australia's most famous Kelpie, Red Dog. Red Dog was well known for his travels through Western Australia's vast Pilbara region. He'd many friends in the area, but in recent years, his legend has grown thanks to a number of books and two hit films. Now there's talk that the Pilbara Wanderer could get a highway named after him. Dr. Rick Fenney was the vet that cared for Red Dog, and Kendall O'Connor caught up with him on the weekend at the Red Dog Festival and spoke to him about the possibility of the Red Dog Highway.
The 40 years is 40 years since he died, or near enough. It was 40 years ago that I had to put him down, and I buried him out near Cossack, where I've also put a little plaque very close to where his grave is. But yeah, it's really great to celebrate it. In 2 years' time, we'll be here again, I think, celebrating his 50th birthday. I say to people, look, I spent probably 4 or 5 years, yeah, probably 5 years knowing Red Dog in life, but for the last 40 years I've probably spent more time talking about him after his death.
Yeah, so are you surprised about how famous he's become?
Not at all. In fact, at this poignant moment after I'd buried him, I sat on a rock out near Cossack, and I thought, oh my God, what have I just done? I've just buried this most important icon, because he was such an icon in his life. He was the spirit of the Pilbara, especially around here, and he embodied the community spirit that was in this area at the time. And then I thought, hang on, he's died, but I think his memory will live on, and I reckon one day there's definitely going to be a book, and who knows, there might be a film made about him, and yeah, definitely a statue. And by the time I got home to Raven, the phone was ringing and people saying, hey Rick, what do you reckon we do a statue? And yeah, and it was so easy. We just got a few people together, organised a few donation tins at the pubs. Next minute we had the money, and we had a little committee. Their names are over there. We got together and had a few meetings and got a sculptress, and next minute, bang, we had him up here. And I vividly remember the ceremony, probably only 6 months later, that where we unveiled the statue here in Dampier.
Yes, a statue, two films, a book, and now possibly a highway named after him.
Yeah, well, this is, I must admit, I didn't think of that at the time. I didn't predict that, but this has sort of come from left field. I've been thinking about it for a while, though, and I thought, you know what, Red Dog used to travel that road, that dusty road between Tom Price and Karratha, a lot, and he seemed to hang out on that road. He used to go to some of the railway camps along the way. I think it was two or three along that road. I'd see him there. He'd run out on the road and get me to stop for him. So to me, that road depicted Red Dog. He was also born in Parabadu, so maybe that was the reason why he went back there. He also, in the movies, he was on that dirty road, and that's the road he was on. But I'd love it to see it sealed. And I think it's the most wonderful idea if we could call it the Red Dog Highway and make it an official road in Western Australia. It's not the Tom Price Karratha Road, known as the Red Dog Highway, but it is the Red Dog Highway. And it'll be such a tourist icon, because the potential to have every truck bay along the way would be an information bay with all these this stuff about Red Dog. And people will come from all over the country and all over the world just to see the Red Dog Highway leading to the Red Dog Trail around Dampier and Karratha.
Pilbara vet Rick Fenney there chatting to Kendall O'Connor in the Pilbara. I'm sure a lot of people would like to take a drive down the Red Dog Highway. That's all from the Australia-wide team for today. And don't forget, you can subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your favourites. I'm Sinead Mangan. Hope you have a lovely evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.